I think that Bob Ryan is one of my favorite human beings on the planet. And you're my favorite uncle. And I think it's like, you know, a lot of people have written me emails or come up to me after shows through the years, and they've said, you know, you're my favorite comedian.
Right.
And I've always really, I always thought, wow, that's a really special thing to be someone's favorite comedian.
Uh-huh.
But beyond that, within your family, to be, you know, everyone has their favorite uncle,
mm-hmm.
and you're my favorite uncle, and you have inspired me in so many ways. And you're into literature and comedy, and you're a novelist, and you did comedy, and you know it may have only been for a year, but God damn it, you did it, and you were a comedian, and you are a novelist, and you are a thinker, and you're an open-minded intellectual guy who has a magnificent sense of humor, and you've been one of the most greatest influences on my life, and. I would not be the person that I am today if it was not for Bob Ryan.
Let me say something in that regard. You know, Tom has been singing my praises, and I love him dearly for that. And, you know, and it's nice to hear that, you know, I was a positive influence in somebody's. It's nice to hear it because you hope that you are, and you never know or whatever. But it's to hear somebody say the words is actually nice. But I just want to say something for all the listeners out there. If anybody who's listening to this, and I assume that anybody who's listening to this is a fan of Tom Rhodes, and let's say loves Tom Rhodes. So if you love Tom Rhodes and his act and everything, then you know, I'm happy that you remember that I'm his favorite uncle. But if you fucking hate him and can't stand his comedy or whatever, and you're just listening out of some perverse weird shit, forget you ever knew me, man. Forget the name Bob Ryan. Okay.
No, but the point is, I would not be the person that I am today if it wasn't for my favorite Uncle Bob, and I am sitting in his magnificent backyard in Vermont. The stars are sparkling. We've got a beautiful little fire burning next to my glowing MacBook computer, and we're passing the microphone back and forth. Our family is from Washington, D.C. I was born in Washington, D.C., as were you and mm-hmm. my brothers and my father, your brother. And
mm-hmm.
There is a certain amount of blackness that our family has and that our family has always celebrated. I've always thought we were the blackest white family in America.
That's right.
And I kind of take pride in that.
That's right.
I really like the jazziness in the way we speak and the rhythm. And I mean, what do you think? I mean, was that just being in a predominantly black city that made that happen? Or why do you think our family celebrates black culture subconsciously so much?
Well, being around so many black folks in D.C., there's no question that that's the major reason that that happened. We grew up and, you know, kind of somewhat lower middle class or whatever when I grew up, which meant we were kind of like on the poorer side, whitey side of town or whatever. I was talking about this with my childhood buddy from the time I was 12 or 10, came up to visit me, and we lived in the neighborhood in Southeast Washington, D.C., Anacostia. And we were basically, I've thought about this since then, we were always right on the edge of the black neighborhood. And so there was a little bit of overlap there, you know, where I would hang with the street on a street corner, you know, sometimes when I was 10 or something, and listen to black dudes tell stories and so forth. Later on, they would always like hurt each other's feelings or, you know, put each other down, but it was a joking cultural thing they did. Later they called it playing the dozens, you know. But back in those days, before that, it was called joning. You were joning on somebody, you know. I hate to talk about your mama. She's a sweet old soul. I can't even tell that. Probably even on the podcast, it's too crude and rotten to tell. But,
please. You tell the worst mom joke, and I'll tell the worst mom joke.
Well, here's the things that shape your worldview. Now, I apologize ahead of time to any delicate sensibilities, but here's the kind of thing that in our neighborhood where we grew up, you say, how did we get blackness or whatever? Well, it's because I was 9, 10 years old, hanging on the street corner with black dudes from down the street, you know, 17 years old or whatever, and they would just hang on a street corner and Joan, see who could hurt each other's feelings the worst or whatever, called Joaning, later called Play the Dozens. And here's the kind of stuff that gets in your head from the time you're like 9. I'm just sitting there looking kind of almost in awe at the black dude, and he goes, let me tell you something, man. I hate to talk about your mama. She's a sweet old soul. She got a tin can pussy and a rubber asshole. She got knives on the titties to open the dough. She got hairs on the pussy to sweep the flow. Okay? Now, that's wrong on so many levels. In today's politically correct, you know, this was how it was, man. Yeah. And in today's politically correct world, you couldn't even begin to think that or say it or whatever, you know?
Well, fuck today's.
Because it's wrong.
Fuck today's politically correct world. The best insult I ever heard on putting down someone's mother is, your mother's pussy is so dry that the crabs carry canteens. Wow, that's dry.
Man. Yeah.
But now, I don't think there's any, I've never heard that story, you telling about being 9 and listening to the black people in the corner. Because I love Hank Williams, and Hank Williams, the greatest country superstar ever, I worship him. Actually, your mother, my grandmother, is why I love Hank Williams. She loved Hank Williams, and that's how I got turned on to him. But I read his biography, and I know a lot about him. He listened. There was a black man in Montgomery, Alabama, that sat on the corner and played guitar, and he wanted him to teach him guitar and would actually give him his quarter. If he, his parents would give him money to go get candy, and he'd give it to the black man to teach him how to play guitar. So there is something to that. I do remember a story that you told me. You were working in a warehouse or something when you were a teenager with all these African-American gentlemen.
Yes, and Nubian gentlemen, you
Nubian
might say.
Gentlemen. And,
Nubian brothers.
And there was a certain thing that they would say on payday.
Yeah.
And I believe it went, dick hard, ball smoking, I need some pussy, and I ain't joking.
Absolutely. That's one of the crudest things ever uttered, but it's the coin of the realm.
Wait. But now I want you to elaborate on that memory, but also I want you to... I want you to also take that further into the historic part of Washington, D.C. history that don't remember. My parents met at Anacostia High School.
That's right.
And you grew up in Anacostia,
that's
which
correct.
Today, and for at least 30 years now, has been one of the blackest areas of the United States.
Right.
I think our family was a part of the white flight. When a black family moved in, the whites all moved to the suburbs. So
right.
You're growing up in a neighborhood that became eventually one of the blackest areas.
And crime-ridden.
In America.
Yes.
What are your memories of that time when it went from white to black?
I have a lot of vivid memories. And again, I was talking to my best childhood buddy who lived through that in the we're talking about he and I when we were 10, 11, 12, 13 in that era right there. And this would have been in the early 60s, let's say, from 60 to 64, from that kind of an era. We were talking about it, and I've realized since then that this was when, you know, black folks were starting to, the revolution was starting to gain some momentum. You know what I mean? It was the time of Martin Luther King. There was a lot of change in the air and so forth, much needed, long overdue. But there was that black power movement was just starting to happen, you know, the militant aspect of it. Like, motherfucker, we had enough of this bullshit, and we ain't gonna take it no more. You ain't gonna hold us down, no goddamn more. So the movement was beginning to start. Well, Fred and I are 10, 11, and 12, and where we lived in Anacostia, we were right on the edge of the black neighborhood. So what I realized now as I thought about it later in life was Freddie and I were on the front lines of where the civil rights clash began, where the black neighborhood kept moving further out of the black neighborhood and into the white neighborhood. And we were literally right on the edge of that. I mean, physically, that's where our neighborhood was located in D.C., in Anacostia. And so we were on the front lines of the civil rights clash when it was just starting to begin, which means we got a lot of black fists swung at our motherfucking heads. Fred and I, we went down to the corner to the sub shop where we used to go all the time. It's called Miles Long on Nichols Avenue. It's now Martin Luther King Avenue in D.C. And we would go down to Nichols Avenue at the bottom of the hill there. And we had gone down and we get the, it was a sub shop, you know, hoagies and whatnot. We would get subs at Miles Long. And one time, you know, some black folks had started to move into our neighborhood, and we went down there, and we almost got our ass beat. Freddie had on a new pair of Chucks, you know, Chuck Taylor high top black shoes, and the dude outside was waiting for him and said, "Motherfucker, give me them shoes." So that's the kind of thing that was going on. There was a lot of hostility and all of that kind of stuff, or whatever. But you know, and I want to clarify one thing I've thought about too. You know, people refer to white folks moving out of those neighborhoods as black folks moved in.
White flight.
It's referred to as white flight. I'd like to reterm that. That wasn't no white flight, motherfucker, because I lived through it, dude. I was there. You wasn't even born yet. Let me tell you something. That was white goddamn common sense. That wasn't no motherfucking white flight. Because that makes it sound like, oh, man, the black man is coming. We better run for no good reason. No, there was plenty of good reason. Them motherfuckers hated us. You can argue what you want. Maybe there was some justification for what had been done to them, but they didn't deserve to hate me, motherfucker. I hadn't done nothing. Okay? So they was coming at my motherfucking head, busting me upside the head and shit for no reason. So it wasn't white flight. It was like, God damn, if we won't survive, these motherfuckers are going to try and kill us. We are going to move. So that's what that was all about. So, yeah, that's what went down. But, I mean, I could go on and on with incidents about like the hostility, man, and things that were going on. That's why there's a couple things that I reflect on about that. When I get politically incorrect or make my commentary about, you know, black folks and whatever, and I don't do it with any animosity in my heart, and truly in my heart, and you know, I'm not a racist. You know, I've had black friends and so forth. But when you comment on that era that I lived through in Southeast D.C., I feel like I'm entitled to talk about it, because, you know, I mean, I was in the trenches, I was on the front line. So it's not, you know, some white boy from Montgomery County or some white commentator sitting by his computer writing a column or an article, a theoretical article about race relations and how they ought to be. And he's discussing it in the safety and sanctity of his office. And he's never lived or hung out with a black person in his life. And I was there, dude. I worked at, you talked about earlier, the D.C. Public School Warehouse. I used to work there. Me and a buddy of mine were the only two white guys. There were nothing but black guys there. And that story you told is one of my favorites. Every day, you know, we got off at 4 o'clock. So there were like about 30 or 40 guys that worked in this warehouse. And me and this other guy were the only two white dudes. And so we'd all gather and throng together to punch out at the time clock. And we got off at 4. So everybody would start gathering at the time clock at 3:57, you know, poised with their time card so they could get punched out right at 4. So in these 3 minutes while we're waiting to punch out, everybody would be talking, you know, and talking shit through the crowd or whatever. And it was always, in every neighborhood I was ever in, black dudes always have nicknames. And there was always a guy named Tootie, you know. And he might have a little bit of a gravelly voice. And I remember just repeating that anecdote you told earlier. Somebody yelled, you know, there's a crowd, all these mingled voices, and everybody's talking at once. And I heard somebody yell, "Hey, Tootie, man, Friday night, what you going to do?" And Tootie said, "I don't know, man. All I know is dick hard, ball smoking, need some pussy, and ain't joking." You know, which is one of the coolest things I ever heard. But anyway, so what I'm saying is, having lived in the midst of all that, dude, I'm entitled, I know whereof I speak, okay? And so I have friends, you know, and listen, man, I want all of us to come together and the whole racism thing and all of us to love each other and all of that to be over with and done. Racism and all that stuff is a horrible, it's the biggest cancer that's eaten our country, you know, since its inception. And it's got to go away and it's got to stop. But at the same time, I'm sitting here talking to my comedian nephew, and goddammit, you got to be honest. You know, you got to tell the truth, man, or it's all bullshit.
Last time I was in Texas, I met a white supremacist dude. Are there any white supremacists here? They never go out to the fucking clubs, man. How are you going to reach these people? What a silly concept, man. A white master race. Does anybody fucking believe that? I mean, anybody who ever studied biology knows the more you mix the genetic code, the stronger our immune systems will become to fight diseases, and we'll all actually live longer as people if you mix the races. Keep mixing the races until we're all the same grayish color. And there'll be no more racism once we're all the same shade, man. Hey, gray. Who you calling gray, gray? Then we'll actually be able to hate someone for the person that they are. Yes. Envision the day when you can hate someone just because he's an asshole. I guess it's easy for me to say mix the races because I'm a bunch of different races. And I lived in New York City for the last couple of years, and they always have these ethnic day parades, man. And I admit it, I got envious, you know. I'd watch these parades and go, huh. Maybe one day my people. You never see a parade for me. You never see a quarter English, quarter French, quarter Italian, quarter don't know what the fuck you really are parade. Hey, it's Confused Bastard Honky Day parade. I'm a quarter everything. My ancestors fucked about everybody. I wish I had some melanin so I don't burn so bad at the beach. Yeah. Oh, thank you for getting that. Thank you. You do that in the Midwest, they never get that problem. Did you put a dictionary at the foot of the table? Everyone should know what melanin is. I think that's where racism comes from, man. White people are jealous of people with melanin. Think about it, man. It comes from thousands of years of white people getting sunburnt at the beach. That's where all the hatred started. White people getting pink and flaky and crispy and... Ouch! Ouch! Don't touch me! Ouch! Shit! People with melanin don't have this problem. I'll give them lower wages. It's the media, huh? Don't you agree?
Yeah.
The media controls all the information we receive. Do you think I'm lying? Whatever happened to Somalia? Weren't they starving to death, man? A couple years ago? Now you don't hear nothing about Somalia. Well, I guess they're full. I guess you go to Somalia now and there's Snickers wrappers everywhere. Everybody's sucking on a toothpick. I'm stuffed. Remember a couple years ago, every night on TV, skinny, bald-headed people starving. Remember? God, it was so hard to enjoy a large pizza back then. Oh, shit, look at that guy, man. He's got fucking turn the channel. Yeah. Oh. He's got flies over his face. Not funny, man. Oh, wait a minute. There's titties in the background. I love titties. Can I say that? Can I come out of the closet? I am a titty lover. I was in Australia. There was a wonderful picture in the newspaper. While I was there, Queen Elizabeth from England was visiting with her husband, Prince Philip. And there was a picture in the paper. They were somewhere in Australia watching some Aboriginal tribal dance. And the women were all dancing and they didn't have any tops on, right? And the Queen had this serious queeny look on her face. And right next to her was Prince Philip going...
What do you remember from your brief but very impactful experience as a stand-up comedian when you were starting that year what were your feelings? Your anxieties, or anything? Just even the club that I saw you perform at. What memories of your experience as a comedian do you remember?
This would have been the late 70s.
I believe 1978.
1978.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So this would have been 1978.
So actually, I would have been 11, not 12.
Okay. So 1978, being a comedian was not on my radar ever at that point. I had never thought of that. That just wasn't anything that happened. What I was like, I was always a funny dude. I mean, I was one of those guys that just had a good sense of humor and would always make people laugh at parties and so forth. And I had a little bit of a flair for doing voices and impressions or whatever. I never really worked on them, so they were so-so, whatever. But anyway, so in D.C., in Southeast D.C., there was a little bar that had been there forever, and it was kind of a redneck bar. It was on Minnesota Avenue in D.C., and actually it was on Pennsylvania Avenue in Southeast D.C., and it was called L. Brookman's. And it was just a little local bar flies and so forth. And on the weekends, they would have country music. And so their son, Paul Brookman, I think his name was, he was going to he was first couple years of college, community college. And he and a buddy said, let's try comedy on the weekends, like Friday night or whatever. So the rednecks, if you will, were coming there expecting to see country music, and suddenly, at least one night a week, as I recall, was Friday nights, was comedy night, open mic night. The country band was sort of pushed aside. You might go up and their instruments would still be on the stage or whatever, but they weren't performing that night. And so the audience would, the regular audience was kind of resentful of that at first, because it's like, hey man, you're taking over our club or whatever. So anyway, it was just an experiment that these two college dudes thought up. And at the time, there was no comedy revolution in America. There weren't this chain of clubs that suddenly, that we're familiar with now, that exploded then from the late 70s and into the 80s and all of that, when there was comedy clubs everywhere. But that was the very beginning. I'm not saying, you know, we were the inventors of it or whatever, but nevertheless.
You were certainly at the forefront.
Absolutely.
I think only New York City, Washington, D.C., maybe Los Angeles and Chicago were probably the only places like that that had comedy clubs. Or not comedy clubs, but places that did comedy at that time.
That's right. But to my knowledge, obviously I don't know what was going on in New York and those other cities, but in D.C., to my knowledge, there was nobody before L. Brookman's, because the only places I ever, and I was kind of hip to comedians, I'd go see them and so forth, and I was always interested in them. But anyway, the only comedy places were nightclubs where established comedians would come to perform, like Richard Pryor or something. But the Cellar Door was a big comedy venue and everything. But if they were out there, I had never heard of them. And I was hip. I was into the scene, so I kind of knew what was going on. So anyway, so suddenly one of my buddies, and it might have been George Wilbur, the guy I was telling you about, one of my buddies from the Wild Dog days, came up to me and said, Bob Ryan, did you hear there's doing comedy on the weekend, on Friday nights at L. Brookman's? I said, nah, get out of here. And whatever, And they said, you should go do that. And I said, nah, you're crazy. Get out of here, whatever. And so So they talked me into it. They said, you're funny, go do this. And I remember being so inhibited about it that a buddy of mine, the first time I went up on stage, he had like a wicker trash basket. And the trash basket had a lid on it. But it was like designed, to look like a bird, this wicker straw thing. So the lid on the basket had had like a little beak and eyes on it and everything. And so to sort of like hide or get the nerve to get up on stage, the very first time I walked up, I had that on my head. So now that's the equivalent of a dude putting a lampshade on his head or some shit. So I went up on stage with the bird, and I don't remember what jokes I told or whatever. So like every Friday night, I would go down there, and you and I have talked about this one part of it before, Tom. I had no idea how stand-up comedy was supposed to be done. I had no idea. How could you know? And so I actually thought that you had to almost like reinvent your act every week I believed that you couldn't tell the same jokes over and over. They'd be stale or whatever. So every week, I was trying to come up with like five or however many minutes of new, brand new material, you know. And now I've since discovered that that's not the way it works. You know, that's not the way it works. If you find a joke that works, keep it. It's not like all the same 75 people are going to be there who heard it before. You know, that's how naive I was. But I remember being back in the kitchen and you know, you had just thought up the jokes and crudely written them out. You know, you had performed on Friday, and then like by Monday or Tuesday or something, in between bongs and whatnot, you had managed to clear your head long enough to like write some stuff down or think up, oh, maybe that's funny. Hasn't ever been tried. You don't know if it's any good, if it's going to bomb or whatever. And so you would be, I would be trying to memorize it even when I was standing in the kitchen waiting to go on.
That's classic. The best joke that I had that I can remember from that period was, because as a comedian, you can only talk about what you know and your experiences. And my experiences when I started when I was 17 and 18 was borrowing my dad's car and going on dates and trying to get laid.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my most killer joke from when I started was I'm on a date with a girl and we're parked in my dad's Chrysler LeBaron and we're smooching and I make the move and I unbutton her pants and she pushes my arm away and she says, if I do anything with you, what's it going to mean?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, for you, a ride home.
I remember that joke quite distinctly. Yeah.
That joke used to kill. That was like, I think that was my closer when Absolutely. I was like 17.
Yeah.
But now you've seen me many times through the years. I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
Well, don't forget that thought, but I was just going to throw in one more joke just for the hell of it. Not necessarily one of my favorites, but one that just popped into mind. A good joke was something about Kojak or Telly Savalas or something with a turtleneck or something like that. You remember that joke?
Oh, something about my penis.
Penis or
something about a penis looked like Telly Savalas with a turtleneck.
Some shit.
That
like
was
that
the descriptive.
Yeah. Okay.
It's all about the details in comedy.
That's right.
Yeah. All I can remember is the joke was referring to a penis.
Of course.
Or my penis.
Mm-hmm.
And then it looked like Telly Savalas with a turtleneck.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Which,
when you're 17, that's,
even today,
that's pretty fucking poetic.
It is. But if you were to do a statistical study of all comedians' material, probably 67% of it has to do with genitals. But anyway, that's just an aside. Go ahead.
But now you saw me from my earliest inclinations as a comedian and through the developing years. And you've seen me in many places.
Absolutely.
All over the world.
Well, not the world so much, but certainly the country.
All over the United States.
A lot of parts of it, yeah.
So, when did you think I first started to get a grasp on it as a comedian? Or what stories can you tell our fortunate listeners about Tom Rhodes in the earliest years?
I don't remember the specific night per se, but I remember when it finally kind of clicked on in my head that, your part of your question was like, did you feel like you had a handle on it when you had arrived, so to speak, as a comedian? And I think it was about 10 years into it. I remember, because you see you from the very beginning, and what would happen is, and I'm sure this is probably pretty much applies to any comedian, you know. But it seems to me that to be a comedian, you just get up there and you keep doing it and you fight your way through the rejection and the heckling and you kind of just learn, because there is no instruction manual on how to do this, you know. You get up there and you keep doing it and you learn what works and you learn what doesn't work. But a part of it is you want to, you're trying almost too hard, beginning comedians, to get them to like you. You want them to like you, to be on your side or whatever. So maybe you do, I'm not saying you per se, but comedians in general will do stuff that's phony or pandering or trying to be ingratiating or trying to be loved. And it's not them, you know, or whatever. But not only that, but you have to, somewhere along the line, you have to continually be trying out jokes. And it's like, you know, flying, it's like being on a tightrope without a net. You know, you throw it out there and you don't know if it's going to work or not until you try it on stage. And so you weed your way through. It's watching you weed your way through some jokes that aren't so great and some that are good, and the keepers, and the material gradually gets tighter and better and you get smoother. I'm talking about you watching this happen, the evolution of your career. And so I would watch this and, like, you know, sometimes you might be trying too hard or, you know, the material would be hit or miss or whatever. And it would be, when I say trying too hard, it's almost like, you know, just trying too hard to please the audience or something instead of, like, just going with material that you felt from the heart or whatever. And so, but anyway, and so there was, around the edges, there might be a little bit of a nervousness or an insecurity or something, you know, some little thing. But after about, it seemed like to me about 10 years that I said, this dude is down. You know what I mean? He's got it. He's there. He's a solid, rock solid professional. His material is airtight. You know, not every joke is going to kill every person. You know, one of my expressions that I have is, in life, nobody bats 1,000 ever in anything. So, you know, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, it's going to be hit or miss or whatever. But as a solid professional comedian, anyway, that's kind of the answer to your question. I felt like, you know, seeing you off and on for like, and not to say that the previous 10 years was chopped liver by any means. You were killing and doing well and so forth. But watching it from not just any casual audience member, but an uncle who has been so close to you and to the inner workings of your soul and your mind and your heart and whatever, and knowing what's true and what's real and all of that kind of stuff, I would sit there and go, okay, you know, we're going from 1 star to 2 stars to 3 stars or whatever. But it was 10 years. And would you say, and I would ask you back this part of that, would you say that's a pretty fair rule of thumb for most comedians when they're learning how to become a solid professional and work their way up to a headliner? Would you say 5 to 10 years is about what it might take to get there?
No, actually, I'm flattered that you say 10 years, because most young comedians, when I'm talking to them and they're asking me these types of questions, I tell them I was about at the 13-year mark.
Where you yourself?
Before I really thought in my own mind that I had a handle on it.
Okay.
But I do think that it takes 10 years, certainly, for anybody. You know, it took me a couple extra.
Right.
You know, I started out on the Southern circuits and some of the toughest gigs in the world. But, yeah, I thought it was about at the 13-year mark where, like, I was like, wow, I'm fucking hot.
I know what I'm doing.
I know what I'm doing, and I can handle any situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly takes 10 years for anybody to get good in this business. I mean, but it takes 10 years to be a dentist or a doctor or a magnificent transmission repairman, you know. And, like, you know, if you want to be the best transmission repairman in the world, you have to study the masters. And
that's
like,
right.
I'm sure as a dentist or a doctor, it's the same, you know. You have your masters that you learn from, and that's certainly in comedy. You have to study the masters. So, what are some of your favorite memories of watching me through the years as the proud uncle who inspired my career choice?
One of the happiest, this is a general thing throughout your career, one of the happiest, some of the happiest moments, let me put it that way, of like watching you perform in comedy clubs would be, you know, you would always get plenty of laughs and everything, but even comedians know this when you're up on stage on the laugh meter. Some nights you were 6, and other nights you were 7. You can tell by the loudness and the universality of the laughing, can't you? I mean, you can tell up there if you the degree to which you're killing. Don't you get a feel for that?
Certainly.
Okay. So the nights, though, when you were really destroying, I mean really just killing, one of the most joyous things for me that I would always do and sit around and look at all the other people in the club. And That would almost bring a tear to my eye sometimes. I would be so proud because I would look around and sometimes, you know, depending on the club, it could be 100, it could be 300 people. And it's jammed. And I mean, virtually everybody in there is just in paroxysms of laughter. And I'm looking around, I'm going, I'm not saying it out loud, but that's my nephew up there, man, doing that, man. He's, look at what he's doing.
Happiness list number 6, Bill Murray. Bill Murray makes me happy because he's given me so many great moments in movie theaters. Stripes was a film that I absolutely loved. I love when he comes off the plane. A party? Who did this? One of my favorite films ever by Bill Murray is What About Bob? And I love it. And Richard Dreyfuss is this, he's this crazy guy in New York City who's afraid to go outside. And he only goes outside with, he's got a little fish bowl with a goldfish in it tied around his neck. And he's just so afraid and he's walking. He keeps going, baby steps, because that's what his psychiatrist, Richard Dreyfuss, told him to do. And then Richard Dreyfuss goes on vacation and, like, you know, he just wrote a book and he's, he goes to Vermont or New Hampshire or somewhere.
How many ways?
And Bill Murray follows him.
What I'd like you to do is to get on this bus and go back to New York.
I can't. I'm totally paralyzed. I'm all locked up.
You got yourself here.
Barely.
No. Getting back will be therapeutic.
But can't we just have a little talk?
Bob, you are testing my patience.
Come on. I've come so far. Bob. I'm baby stepping. I'm doing the work. I'm baby stepping. I'm not a slacker. Check it out. Look at, I'm in really bad shape. Come on, please.
Bob.
Please.
Bob.
Give me. I need. Give me.
Okay. Please.
And he comes, and Richard Dreyfuss just wants to be alone with his family and hates this guy. And it turns out his family ends up loving him. And everything he does just annoys Richard Dreyfuss. And there's a great scene where they're eating dinner. And he just keeps, he's just moaning. He's, So it's ridiculous how much he's loving this food and the family's all cracking up. And Richard Dreyfuss is fuming. And then Richard Dreyfuss takes him out sailing and he ties him to the mast of the ship. And it's, there's a great scene where Bill Murray's all tied up and he goes, I'm sailing! I'm really sailing! And of course, Richard Dreyfuss is trying to kill him. And he ends up, Richard Dreyfuss tries to blow up his house and kill him. It's a ridiculous comedy.
Chicks dig me because I rarely wear underwear, and when I do, it's usually something unusual.
That this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
Biblical.
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
Is this true?
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
I smell vermin poontang. And the only good vermin poontang is dead vermin poontang. I think.
I'm a god, and not the god. I don't think.
But the real excitement, of course, is going to come at the end of the summer, during Sexual Awareness Week. We import 200 hookers from around the world, and each camper, armed with only a thermos of coffee and $2,000 cash, tries to visit as many countries as he can. And the winner, of course, is named King of Sexual Awareness Week and is allowed to rape and pillage the neighboring towns until camp ends.
Bill motherfucking Murray. This is the Steve Zoom Remix.
It was time for quick change, so I had to rush home. I was on the razor's edge in this little shop of horrors. The man in the middle swinging for some osmosis. Jones and Debbie Golden Globes award show hopes in slow motion. Space Jam, Michael Jordan to the max. One thing, not that I'm a dynamite Caddyshack. Photon pack charged up for some ghostbusting flights. No marshmallow men in sight. Looming larger than life.
Larger than life.
Liquid swords, hammer of iron and straps like a sergeant. Coffee and cigarettes, visages of Jim Jarmusch got me. Gargling arsenic, and Garfield was miserable. Asking Richard Travis, what about Bobby Digital? Ignoring medical advice like my pals, John and Gilda. With friends like these, who needs anything else to kill you?
Else to kill you.
Minnesota stuff to go home. I can't have an extension where the buffalo roam. So I left the second city, next stop, Greenwich Village. Live from New York, it's Saturday night, top billing.
Top billing.
Hero and villain,
hero and villain.
Not talking glory, best of videos now. Catalog stories, scene selection, scene-driven dreams with fast. A kingpin who's screwed, visiting Christmas past. Flipping back and forth, we run sound the same. Pay dues and deja vu on every groundhog day. Down hallways and new shoes, a who's who people. Tootsie rolling backwards, feeling like a meatball. They're calling all the women that have passed through my hamlet. They get lost in translation, scarlet fever. Your hands are going to weave in romance. Feeding seem all fresh, cause that screen and technicolor redirected. Edward, petrified when we start speaking of sex. All of Charlie's angels turn to demons and ex-girlfriends. Turn the tables, Dr. Van may get shot. She's having a baby and the cradle will rock. Playing lock, life aquatic with loyal cast abound. Staying carpe diem like a royal Tannenbaum. Resting from the voyage, joining me in video tapes. All doom go away, the mic run about to show. Kids, old age is setting it. Honors to do proper. Coast of mine hosting when I should be winning Oscars, yeah. Bill motherfucking Murphy.
My recollection of your style. And I only came up with this word because I saw it in Belgium. In Belgium, a lot of the comedians are, they have absurdist style, where they're just so all over the place. And it's just, I actually think it's very inventive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's probably one of the most dangerous styles that you could do to inhabit an animal's brain for a minute. And that was my recollection of your style, is that you were like an absurdist comedian in Belgium that I've seen. That it wasn't only monologues. It was you acted things out intensely, and you inhabited objects and animals and things, and was very much like a cartoon when you were on stage.
That's true. I mean, I've done some drama and some acting and so forth. And so there is that kind of thing, in me. And that would be my kind of approach, is just to take a premise. And then once I got into it, I could start ad-libbing or riffing or whatever. Now, I don't want anybody to mistake that I'm comparing myself to Robin Williams, and the genius that
he were very much like Robin Williams.
But
you were, in my opinion, you were very much like Robin Williams.
Had I pursued it, that was kind of my style, yes. It was like to get up there and be manic and go wall to wall. My comedy was wall to wall, man, and it was all out. But it was acting out cartoon characters in your head. I remember a bit I used to do where I talked what was just coming into being in technology was you would have cars that would like talk to you, give you messages, close your door, and that kind of stuff. Machines would start giving you little messages. And I used to do a bit about automatic teller machines. What if they started having recordings to kind of talk you into that, talk to you while you were getting your money? And so I imagined different recordings, like if you were at Catholic University and you went to a teller machine, the teller machine would be called Father-O-Matic, of course, he's got, he'd be saying, "Wait a minute now, laddie. Do you really need the money? Because I'm thinking, no, I'm not presuming to know your business, but I'm thinking you're probably going to go out on drugs and sex and so forth. Do you really want to spend your hard-earned cash?" So that would be the lecture of Father O'Matic. And, but at Howard University, an all-black university, it would be a whole different message, You'd be coming back, and the machine would be going to you, "No, motherfucker, you ain't getting shit from me. You were just here you were here an hour ago, bitch. You fucked up that $100 already? I don't think so. I ain't gonna give you shit." And so that was one of my bits of shtick that I did. But yeah, I would be absurdist and wall-to-wall about it, no question.
What do you remember from my beginnings in comedy? Because you've seen me from the beginning. And what are some of your most horrendous memories of me starting out as comedy? And what are some of your best memories of me starting out as a comedian? Following in your footsteps, I might add.
Well, the earliest recollections I have of you as a comedian, let me think. You know, I didn't see you at the very, very beginning. You started like as a junior or senior in high school, as I recall. When you started, I don't think I was around because you started when I was out of town, so to speak. But anyway, so then I'd start catching up with you at comedy clubs and everything. And a couple of my earliest recollections are like, I don't remember the jokes per se, you know, but you generally seem to have an affinity for it. You were smooth. As I recall in those days, there were times when you wore like a suit. Did you wear a suit at some earliest stages?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. And I seem to remember a shiny suit. It was like a silver shotgun suit or something like
that. It was the 80s, man, and I was...
I don't mean to diss you. You ain't got to explain to the people.
I've always been a clothes whore. I love clothing to this day. Certainly, I've made many fashion mistakes.
Correct.
In the 80s, people
were... It was happening.
No, I remember wearing shiny suits with bolo ties.
And it was very... And you were looking good, baby. I'm telling you now.
Hey, speaking of the 80s, I get so sentimental when I drive past the Altamont Mall. I wish I could accumulate all the clothes I ever bought at the Altamont Square Mall and have one big fashion mistake garage sale. Oh my God. I left there happy with members only jackets. Fucking parachute pants. They're gonna love me in Oviedo High. I need parachute pants. All right. Hey, look at my bald spot, everybody. Actually, that is not a bald spot. That is an old breakdancing injury.
So it's funny, you were talking about El Brookman's and that it was a country bar. And it shows you how, you know, your memory of things can be very romanticized in your own brain. Whereas where I've always told the story, El Brookman's was a black club. Mm-hmm. And it was a predominantly black audience. And that was the way that I remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, your brother, took me to see you. I was 11. And we walked in and there was a shotgun shack type of room.
That's right.
And the stage was next to the door.
Right.
And I was wearing a Washington Redskins jacket. And the comedian on stage grabbed me, pulled me on stage, and he interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins.
Okay.
And I was 12, and I gave bashful little one-word answers. Yes and no. And
right.
Could barely look up, but I do remember looking up and seeing the people's happy faces thrown back with laughter and all the teeth in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the moment that changed my life. And then I sat at the bar with my dad and sipped Cokes, and I watched all these other comedians and then you. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment that changed my life. So, my life has certainly been full of adventure, and I've had the most blessed and charmed life. And I certainly owe you all the thanks for that, because had you not tried to be a comedian in that period, who knows what I would be doing now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny that you clarify that it was actually a country bar,
mm-hmm,
and not a black club in D.C. the way I remembered it. Now, what do you think? Now, you only did it for a year.
More or less.
What do you think were the obstacles at that time and why you didn't pursue it from there?
There were a couple things. The main obstacle, I'd have to say, I guess, if I was being perfectly honest, was myself. You know what I mean? I didn't have the dedication or the fire in the belly or the intestinal fortitude that you probably needed to withstand the rejection and the bombing. Now, I want to clarify one thing. I was talking about like how bad bombing was, because I remember bombing. But I did kill sometimes, too, and that was incredibly exhilarating. So for the record, I did kill sometimes.
For the record, you've always been funny, and I've always considered you one of the funniest human beings I've ever known in my life. So, you know, why you couldn't harness that, I mean, there was not the comedy club circuit that there was today. I think in any other – actually – I think if you would have started out in Belgium today, you'd be a fucking superstar.
Maybe I need to move to Belgium. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. And why I'm absolutely, you know, a person you could ask about Al Brookman's to double check if I'm, you know, right about Al Brookman's being the very first place to start this kind of a comedy thing in D.C. Ask Rich Scheidner. You know, he would know. But anyway, and Rich Scheidner came down there. But so I remember, though, shortly after, what happened is Al Brookman's became hip, man. It became the in spot to go to. So, like, Georgetown High Rollers and everything would go start coming to little Al Brookman's that had been this little nothing redneck barfly haunted place, man. And suddenly it was the hot spot. And there were no other ones, because what happened was, is people would come to Al Brookman's and you see this well-dressed crowd. And I remember one of the coolest moments in my little open mic exploits there of doing this and not, you know, knowing what I'm doing or whatever. But I remember somebody said, they saw me like going up to the stage or something, and somebody whispered to somebody, "There he is." And that was the coolest thing, man. Somebody somewhere had actually recognized me and come back. They had told their friends, "Let's go see this dude.
There's that funny
guy. He's funny." Yeah, he's funny. So that was one of the cool moments I remember. Anyway, so, but this well-dressed Georgetown kind of hip upscale crowd started coming. So a buzz got out about Al Brookman's. And when it got out, then 6 months later or a year later, other comedy clubs started to pop up. There was one I remember in Georgetown somewhere. I don't remember the name of it or whatever. But suddenly, then it was like exploding. Every 6 months, there'd be another one. There'd be another one out of Crystal Village or whatever, Crystal City in Virginia or whatever. And suddenly, there were two or three or four. And I know that that happened because Al Brookman, they had said, "Well, damn, you can do this. You know, look what's happening at Al Brookman's." And somebody really refined it. Instead of just starting one up on a whim in a redneck bar, they actually had a club specifically for that or whatever. So anyway, that was the dawn of that movement. But I kind of digressing there. I forget what our original topic was there, what we were talking about my memories of comedy. And I remember.
What were the obstacles that kept you from going further? I mean, I know that there was not the comedy club chains that maybe if there would have been all the chain comedy clubs at the time when you started that there are now, maybe you probably would have had a career in comedy. But take that away. What do you think kept you from going further as a comedian?
Yeah, that's a good point, and I don't think that was it though. I think it was I had a lot of other things going on in my life right then. At the same time, I was going to University of Maryland and trying to finish my classes out there. So I was doing this on the weekend and, you know, whatever. And in between, and I was – the time it takes to write an act or whatever, you know, was taken away from my studies. My mother was also badly ill at the time, and so I was kind of looking after her. But that's kind of sounds a little bit to me, even to myself, of like maybe making excuses a little bit. The thing I think ultimately was, Tom, I wasn't thick-skinned enough. I wasn't thick-skinned enough to fight my way through the heckling and the rejection or the occasional bombing and stuff. It just the times that I killed was absolutely exhilarating, and I loved it. There's no cooler feeling, you know, than to look out, man. And I mean, when I say killing, you know, this room held 75 people jammed in there to the rafters or whatever. It was, like you said, it's this little shotgun bar thing. And maybe 100, but 75. But to see them almost as one organism explode into laughter at your joke, oh, my dear Jesus. You know, it was just the greatest feeling and so forth. And I love it. But the rejection hurt so much, man. I mean, the times I bombed. And so, you know, it's just if you can't get through that, you can't be a comedian. You know what I mean? You just got to get through that.
Yeah, it's really true. And the advice that, like, when comedians talk to me and the young comedians and they ask me for advice, you know, a piece of advice that I always seem to be giving young comedians that I think is the truest to be a comedian is that you have to be your own best corner man.
Mm-hmm.
The way that Muhammad Ali had Bandini Brown.
Right.
You have to be, because there's so much in comedy especially. I mean, everything in show business is designed to hurt your feelings. But in comedy especially, there's so much rejection and humbling, dying experiences when you're starting out, the first 10 years especially, that you have to, you know, be like a boxer's corner man for yourself. And, you know, keep staying there, champ. Keep jabbing. Keep That's sticking. Right. And don't give up.
One of the things we've talked about over the years is his career and everything. And the nature of show business is such that it's an ego-driven business, you know, and comedy feeds your ego, and there's no question about it. So you have all these abstract ideas of success and measuring yourself. How successful am I? Am I a star? Am I a headliner or whatever? And so as you're growing and maturing, you kind of worry about those things. But you reach a certain age, and hopefully, if your head is screwed on reasonably tight, you realize that that, you know, a level of success or whatever, or however you define that elusive term, that's not the end all and the be all of it. You know, it's like living a life and being a decent human being, you know, and keeping your body and soul together. Don't you think?
Absolutely. And I just realized one of my most proudest moments in comedy that I never realized before, because it was something I was always ashamed of. In the period after my sitcom was canceled, Mr. Rhodes, it ran 1996 to 1997 on NBC. 1998, I moved to New York City, and I was just hell-bent. And I was angry at humanity and show business and life and family. I had been taken advantage of by a few people. And a lot of my best friends in the business stopped taking my phone call. And I went into the toilet. I went into a tailspin. And I had always been really anti-hard drugs. I didn't even like marijuana when I started. That was something I got into later as I became a comedian. And it was something so prevalent in the camaraderie of comedy. And, hey, let's smoke a joint after the show.
Right.
When my sitcom was canceled, man, I really was angry at life and humanity, and I moved to New York City, and I had a ton of money, and I became all fucked up on cocaine, and I was doing tons of cocaine and ecstasy and whatever I could get my hands on, and I just realized the one of my proudest moments of my career was in that two-year period, 1998, 1999, 2000, maybe, mm-hmm. 2-3 year period,
okay,
where I really became a fucked up mess because I was just so angry mm-hmm. and bitter on drugs that I kept that away from my family. And I mm-hmm. just realized that as much of a low point in my life as that was, that I totally avoided the family whatsoever in mm-hmm. that period. Mm-hmm. So I just realized that. But yeah, that was the most pathetic low point of my career. Mm-hmm. And I never, you know, I moved to Holland and I got lots of love there and I had a great television career. And actually Holland gave me my confidence back
mm-hmm.
because if you saw me in 1998, 1999, I had no confidence and I was Mr. Slump Shouldered guy. Were on stage, I had always been a prowling panther.
Right.
I had always been full of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And just talking to you now, I realized that in that period where I went into the toilet, I totally avoided my family because
mm-hmm.
I didn't want you to see that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But now, that's, you know, God, that's 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I would never let anything affect me that severely as that mm-hmm. did then. But mm-hmm. that was because, you know, I had just, my life was comedy. My life was show business and it had disappointed me.
Sure. Of course.
And it just, you know, you're right. But for the most part, I think I'm one of the lucky people in that I love what I do and I'm happy doing it now. But at a certain period, I did care about television, and I did care about what other people thought of me.
Sure, of course.
And when that became a disappointment, I completely spiraled out of control
mm-hmm.
In drugs and self-hatred.
We've been talking about, like, the highlights and the good part and the wonderful part of comedy and so forth. But there's a dark side, man. And you know, I've thought about it a lot. So whereas on the one hand, you know, I'm flattered and honored in a sense that maybe I inspired you to do comedy and so forth. But comedy, if you're not careful, can take a huge toll on your soul. There's no question about it. And so, you know, it's kind of a mixed blessing. I go, okay, well, you know, Tom is having a cool life and getting to see and do all these things and everything. But I know goddamn well that comedy, not just for you, but for comedians in general, that's one of the worst occupational hazards of comedy, is becoming a bitter old comic. Because, you know, everybody dreams of being a headliner or being a star or having their show or, you know, and having big money and seven figures and all those things. I mean, let's not pretend that, you know, we don't all kind of want that. We don't necessarily lust after it or whatever. But, you know, and so you start to go, well, you know, you see your life playing out or whatever. And but not only that, but also being a comedian, when you're a comic and you're in the club and everything, basically people go to comedy clubs, it's kind of to party. It's a party of sorts. And you're the life of the party. You're the center of the party. You're the one that's making the party happen. And so the mood that you engender in the audience is like, what a cool fucking dude, man. He's funny. I want to party with that dude or whatever. And so you're going to get free drinks, free drugs, all of that stuff. And you can't traffic in that realm but for so long until it's going to do some damage, not just physically or whatever, but possibly to your soul if you don't keep it, you know, in check or whatever. So there's that risk there. So, but the way to avoid that, as I see it, and the tough part of being a comedian, as I see it just from an outsider as a civilian, is you have to maintain enough discipline in your spirit and, you know, a sound mind and a sound body or whatever. And it's extremely difficult to do because decadent shit is being presented to you all the time. Drugs, liquor, whatever, it's all there for the taking. And so it's only your own sense of self-discipline, which if I had pursued comedy, God knows where I'd have ended up when I was a wild dog in my 20s or whatever. I don't know if I'd have had the intestinal fortitude or the strength to avoid the temptations to a killer degree, you know what I mean? Who knows? But anyway, so that temptation is always there, but if you can keep your head together and be professional about it, you know, and be a solid human being, you can avoid that, and I think keep your career on check. And even if you never, you know, you don't get the movie deals or whatever, I don't mean just you, but any comic, you know, who makes their way to a headliner or whatever, you know, don't covet those things. You know what I mean? Just say, well, you know, I'm making a good living, and you know, this is a cool way to make a living, and not let yourself just be too far drawn into the trappings or whatever. But so there's some dangers, you know, and some dark side to comedy.
What would be the greatest advice that you could give me now as a comedian or a man to live the rest of my life?
Believe in yourself and realize and know the richness of your life and how important your life is to me and many, many others that you've touched. This is way above and beyond just being a stand-up comic. Treasure the richness of the experience of the life that you've lived and know how important it is and that you have a lot to say to this world and to give to this world and that your soul and the fact that you're here, you were put on this earth, is extremely important and that you are loved by more people than myself than you can possibly imagine. But never forget how important your life is, man. What a good soul you are, and keep that part of you. Treasure it and keep it pure and keep it good. At those inevitable times when you or anybody will get depressed, I want you to always keep that, you know, in mind of that you, how much you're loved and how important and impactful your life has been to people. I enjoyed the free beers you were able to throw my way. That was another perk. Another fucking purr. Because God knows you owed me a few since I was pumping you full of them at age 13. No, I wasn't. Sarah, that's his mother. If she hears this, I was not pumping your boy full of beer when he was 13. Tom, help me out here, dude.